Back in 1951, Mary Stuart starred in the new soap opera called Search for Tomorrow, where she was known to her viewers as Jo. She's still known to her viewers as Jo, since she and the soap opera have successfully held the attention of viewers since 1951. In her new autobiography, called Both of Me, Stewart quotes an early CBS press release for Search for Tomorrow, and I'd just like to read that to you. CBS TV's Search for Tomorrow is the compelling story of the Barron family, father, mother, daughter-in-law, and grandchild. It's the story of an American family dominated by the old-fashioned elders, successful and secure. It's the story of a young widow and her child and their pathetic struggle to voice the ideas of the young. It's the story of the folks next door and the misunderstandings and heartbreaks that mar their lives. Son Keith Barron, a year out of the Navy, and his wife Joanne come into conflict with the elder Barrons when they balk at following in the old man's footsteps. Keith's sister Louise is a sympathetic ally, as is young Dr. Ned Hilton. Keith's sudden death embitters his parents, who then turn their unhappiness upon their son's widow. Well, in today's Philadelphia Inquirer soap opera column, this afternoon's edition of Search for Tomorrow is capitalized like this. Today, Stu warns Jo that her marriage to Martin will only bring heartache, since the man is a heavy drinker and a gambler. Martin assures Stu that he will spend the rest of his life trying to make Jo happy. It's a long time for a soap opera to be running from 1951 till now. Mary Stuart, star of Search for Tomorrow and author of the autobiography Both of Us, is in the studio with me now, and Search for Tomorrow is shown here on Channel 10 at 12:30 in the afternoons. Mary, great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
You've been doing this for 29 years.
Going on, yes. Give or take a decade, yes.
I'm going to ask you to describe Joanne, then describe yourself,
okay,
and tell us what parallels there are between the two of you.
She is 5'6", she weighs 131 pounds, and she has gray eyes, and oddly enough, so do I. She is a listener. She is a very thoughtful, very kind woman. She is patient. She is all-giving, loving. She's always right. I think that's the thing I've admired about her. Most of all, no matter what happens, she's right when she makes a decision. I am the same height and weight and have the same gray eyes. I'm very hesitant. I'm never sure that I'm right. I'm very often wrong. And the combination has been a good one, because where she charges, in the outline, she makes the decision instantly, I give it serious second thoughts. I go round the barn before I make the decision. And we've got along very well. I admire her, and she's very good for my ego.
You kind of expect some viewers to relate to you as the character who you portray on television.
They do.
But what about the actors who you work with? When you walk into the set in the morning, do they think of you as being Jo or Mary?
Oh, they think of me as Mary, the slave driver. I'm the one who wants to rehearse all the time. None of them do. No, it's a very easy group. It's funny. We, in rehearsals, talk about food, dieting, and menus, and tell jokes. It's a very professional atmosphere for most people who are there.
The expression soap opera stems from the fact that...
From old radio days, yeah.
Because when it was...
everything was owned, and we're
soaps.
Owned by... Yeah, we're owned by a soap company.
By Procter & Gamble.
Yeah.
Now, when the series started in 1951, what was the role of Procter & Gamble, since the role of the sponsor has changed so much in the past
It's funny,
years?
Procter & Gamble is this gigantic company, only has 5 or 6 people in the production, in the television production. Back in those days, I know on the first show that we did, the head of Procter & Gamble Productions flew in from Cincinnati and stood in the control room while we did the show. That was the day the production supervisor chewed his handkerchief in half. Everybody was so nervous. And they locked the producer in a broom closet to keep him out of the control room. They just liked us in those days. I don't remember any interference. We had a producer, director who, it seemed to us, had total control. We were sort of an autonomous little group. We went up, we rehearsed. They didn't have rehearsal halls in those days. We rehearsed in an office, and the only furniture we had was from the Salvation Army. We paid $1 a piece for some chairs, and that's how we rehearsed. Of course, we didn't spend much more than that on the whole production. It was $8,000 a week, covered everything. We had no sets. You could see straight through. We hung door frames in thin air against a black cyclorama. And we had 1 hour of rehearsal for the whole show.
Did the sponsor audition you, or was it people from the production team who did that?
I never auditioned. It was just dumb luck. My formula for success is one-third talent, one-third drive, and one-third dumb luck. And I've really had my share of dumb luck over the years. I was in an acting class. It was a remarkable acting class. There were some stunning people in it. And one night after class, one of the men who never had performed, I had noticed him standing in the back, came up to me and said, I was sent here to watch you because they want you to play the lead in a show called Search for Happiness. That was the first name of it. And I've been watching you, and I think they're right. Let's have lunch tomorrow and talk money.
Hmm.
So I auditioned without ever knowing it.
I want to get back to the sponsor for a minute.
Sure.
How have you seen the role of the sponsor change in daytime programming?
Well, I don't see it change. I kind of feel it change. I think as the numbers have gone up, it's become more important. There's still only about seven people running all that television. They buy more television time than any other company in the world. But it's still a little company out in Cincinnati, and these same seven or eight people make all these decisions. But I know they're in all the meetings now. They didn't used to have big story conferences. In those days, I remember a meeting between the writer and the director on the front steps of Liedekranz, and he said, if you cut out more than 2 minutes of the show, let me know so I can use it in another one. If you cut it out in one hunk. They didn't even have a television set in the town where he lived, a television station, so he never saw the show. It was that simple. It was that nobody was serious about it. But now, I guess because it costs so much money, they take much more active interest. They're there.
When the show started, television was still new. Live television was the way it was done. Were you able to take a lot of risks and, you know, figure out what to do day by day and take chances? Was there less at stake?
Well, your whole life you felt was at stake. I remember the feeling that, you know, don't look back because you know somebody's gaining on you. You were taking such a chance just going on the air on a show that you hadn't rehearsed. 1 hour rehearsal for a whole show. You've barely gotten a grasp of the lines. You've rewritten them. We never rehearsed the last 3 minutes of the show that I remember. We just winged that every day. It's working without a net. That's the only way I can describe it. It's terrifying. It was. And you take chances. There was no norm. We were making up a medium in those days. So there was nothing to compare it with. Everything, I guess, was a chance. A way to express something. We used ourselves, ourselves.
Compare that to what happens now when you do a daily show.
Oh, well, now it's on tape, and now it's done mostly in segments, and a show is a scene. They'll do two or three tapings of it the way they do in the movies till they get it the way they want it.
So you now just have to memorize a small scene.
Oh, you
scene
still
at
have to memorize it. I still work the way I always did. Because I was trained in those days, and that's just my habit.
So what would you'd go home every night after doing the show, read the script, memorize it, come in early in the morning and do it, and go home and do the whole thing
learn
all over
another
again.
One. Yeah, yeah.
And it's the same way now.
I learn the script in the morning now. I'm fresher, and there's not that terrible pressure. I used to feel that I had to know every single line in the script, not only my lines but everybody else's. Because when you're out there live, if somebody misses a cue, if they can't think of something to say, somebody had better. And it was my show, so I always assumed that responsibility. I always figured, I better say something. And I felt that I had to be prepared, so I was.
Ratings are considered to be a very, very important thing for television. Has that importance changed for you? Has the talk of ratings and the pressure of ratings changed over the years?
I guess it has. I've never been concerned. There were years. We were number one for so many years. The first 7 or 8 years we were on the air, we were number one, just hands down. Of course, when we went on the air, there was only one station in town. You can't be number two if there's only one station. Now there's a lot of competition. So even instead of ratings, it'd be your share of the time. Did you have 30% of the audience available at that moment. And the audience has changed. You know, 50% of the women have now gone to work. It's a very different society than it was in those days.
You think there's a lot more men watching now?
There have always been a lot of men watching.
How do you know that?
The mail. I can tell from the mail that I get.
What's the difference between the mail you'll get from a man and the mail you'll get from a woman?
Signatures. You know, the same. They're people.
They writing respond to a friend. The same kinds of things?
Yeah, they're writing to a friend. Joanne is one of the continuing things in a changing society. She has gone through 3 decades of enormous change. I know so many young people say, when I went away to college, I was so lonesome, and Joanne was one of the people who went with me. After college, I went to take a new job in Chicago, and the first thing I did was turn on the television. Yes, I've got my family. There's Jo.
How did feminism affect Joanne?
She learned a lot. Listening, because she's not a feminist, as I'm not a feminist. I'm too old to be a feminist. You can't change the whole way you grew up and your beliefs. But my daughter, who is 25, has much more sense of herself. I've learned an enormous amount from her. Just feeling important as a person. It was an idea that came to me late in life. I felt it was important to be a good mother, important to be a good wife, a good actress. It never occurred to me that I was important just because I got up in the morning and I was a person.
What aspects of Jo's character have you found that the audience is most responsive to?
I can't tell, because I'm on the inside of her characters, I'm on the inside of me. It's almost profound, the reaction to her. I react to her, too. She gives me a lot of self-confidence. She gives me a sense of continuity and strength. She's been an enormous help to me. It's hard for me to know. I had a secretary for years who said, it's spiritual. There's an almost spiritual quality. But I can't tell. I don't watch myself, so I don't know.
Let me quote something from your autobiography, Both of Me. You say that at a party in Moss Hart's living room, and this was years ago, someone said to you, "Don't you miss real acting?" Implying that soap opera acting was less than real. How do you feel about statements like that?
Well, that was a silly little girl who had just graduated from Yale Drama School, and it's the kind of callow, idiotic remark. For years, people put down soap opera acting, even though if you think of our beginning cast, Lee Grant, Don Knotts, we had stunning, stunning people. Tom Poston was in the first 3 or 4 years. We've always had brilliant actors. It's not the performances. Sometimes our material is less than Shakespeare, way less than Shakespeare, but certainly not the performances. I think the media and people in general have always put soap opera down almost automatically. And I think that has a lot to do with the attitude toward women. It was something that housewives did. Housewives watched soap operas, and anything a housewife did had to be dumb, because housewives were dumb.
Do people still put down soap opera acting to the extent that they did?
They don't put it down at all. They don't put down soap operas anymore, really. Well, not the way they used to. Of course, they still do a little bit. There's a little bit of a joke about it. We make jokes about it ourselves. You know, sometimes the scripts are awful. And we don't like them either. But by and large, it's the medium itself. It's the attitude toward the medium. It's very personal. It's one-to-one communication. And when it's good, there's nothing like it.
Do you find a lot of people trying to get their start by being in a soap opera so that they can get the television experience and the acting experience?
Yeah, nearly everybody started there. Either that or in regional theater. When we first went on the air, it was the only ensemble acting there was anywhere. Now there are other places to get it.
I just can't count how many cover stories I've seen in the past 2 months on sex and the soaps.
Me too.
How do you think the ethics and the taboos within soap operas have changed?
Well, in 1951, it was absolutely forbidden to have a double bed, to have two people in a double bed. We had a double bed, and we were both in it, my husband and I. Because we were so unimportant, nobody even watched. Even the censors didn't watch. So we got away with it for years. Over the years, I think daytime television, not just our show, but all of them have tackled subjects that nighttime wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. They couldn't. They talked about abortion early in the 60s, long before anybody else did. We talked about impotence. We talked about all kinds of subjects, that it's all right to talk, like two women would talk about at lunch, but you would never discuss at a family dinner table, or in the evening when the children are there, when it's a mixed group. The sex now is just, it's not just sex in the soaps, it's sex in everything. It's the nude beaches. It's a different time. It's a lot of emphasis on it. It will pass. Surely.
So
we won't need all that hype. Maybe it's those with the Romans, and you know, in their decline, they had to send for the dancing girls to keep the birth rate up. The birth rate is falling. Maybe we need sex on the soaps.
Soap opera life is so complicated.
Mercy, yes.
Every day something terrible happens, and you have a feeling that things are going to work out for the worst, that things are going to get worse before they get better, and you just brace yourself waiting for someone to say a nasty thing behind someone's back that's going to even yet be misinterpreted.
No, that's an oversimplification. It isn't that. I think there are too many illegitimate babies, and too often if a girl makes one mistake, she has the baby. That there's still the old mores. We've hung on to those. I don't think it's so much the door slamming at the wrong moment, the misanthropes. They keep the story on a low level of human experience. Human experience is bigger and broader than that and capable of more. That's where I would like to see them go. Instead of dwelling entirely on people waking up in the morning looking absolutely stunning with their eyelashes on and their fancy nightgowns. And
but aren't people usually really mean on soap operas? When I tune one in, I'm usually really happy that all those people don't live on my block, because I figured they'd be, you know, picking your trash and just, trying, if you're married, they're trying to cheat on your husband or whatever.
Yeah,
everyone's so mean.
Well, the two or three of them have got to be. Yeah.
To keep the plot rolling.
I suppose.
How much has to happen within a week for the
I don't think they
action
have those,
to happen?
I don't think they have those rules anymore. It's not the deliberate five-day cycle that we used to have with the Friday cliffhanger. They don't bother with that. For one thing, they're so far out of sequence all the time, they'd lose track.
What's your analysis of what's enabled Search for Tomorrow to last for as long as it has?
Must be doing something right. There's a sweetness about the show. There's a family attitude. Even though we make mistakes and have an occasional bad year, on the whole, over the years, we've been constant. We've been a family. We've been real. And the audience is loyal to that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Stewart, and she's been with Search for Tomorrow since it started back in 1951. She's known to her viewers as Jo, and she's written an autobiography of herself and of her work in Search for Tomorrow, as well as in the movies and in music. And her book is called Both of Us.
Both of Me.
Both of Me, right. Now, there's some very interesting parallels that happen, I guess, out of necessity between you and the character Jo. Now, you were in the hospital for 5 weeks once.
Mm-hmm.
You had an ectopic pregnancy, mm-hmm. That is the egg lodged in one of the tubes.
And that's what I found out after they took it out, yes.
Well, you were very sick and performed hemorrhaging for about 3 weeks, but
yep.
The show must go on.
I went to work in an ambulance for 3 weeks.
The ambulance would pick you up at home and
yep.
Bring you to work. What leads you to do that when you know you must be sick? Why didn't you run right off to the doctor and check it out?
Well, I did go to the doctor. I thought I was just having a miscarriage, and it was lasting a long time. Not going to work is something that never entered my head. Actresses go to work as long as they can stand up. I finally passed out too many times on the show in one day, and they did write me out for 5 weeks.
So that was 5 weeks you were in the hospital. What happens to your character?
They
when
recast.
Like
that time they had another girl playing it.
That must be strange for viewers.
It was, yes, and they've never done it again.
So this time, if you have to leave, the Jo goes on vacation.
Yes. Jo goes upstairs and slams the bedroom door, and that's the last you hear of her until she's back.
Well, after you recovered from that, you did later become pregnant.
Yes.
What was the reaction to having a pregnant Jo on?
Well, the first time we didn't show that she was pregnant. We just photographed me from the chin up for quite a long time. And I was a June bride in my eighth month, the fattest June bride you've ever seen. absolutely stunning in a bright red coat that I bought. It was a size 16. When I went to buy maternity clothes, went to buy a dress for the wedding, I said, I need a dress for a wedding. And she said, well, dearie, the size 16s are on that rack over there. It was not, now that, you know, in maternity shops, they show wedding dresses every June, but not in those days. The second year, when I was pregnant 14 months later with Jeffrey, well, less than that, 5 months later, because they're only 14 months apart, they decided to write him in. And for the first and, I think, last time on live television, we followed a pregnancy. I worked Friday, and he was born Tuesday.
Why was it the first and last time? What's the objections to someone who is really pregnant portraying someone who's pregnant?
Nothing's the matter with it. It's just chancy. Because to work that long, live television, you can't just leave in the middle of a show and say, I'll finish this later.
I guess you're also confined to real time. Because if you're going to be pregnant for 9 months,
uh-huh.
they can't skip ahead a year.
No.
They've got to really do it on a day-by-day basis.
Yeah.
Is that usually the time format that the show operates in anyways, day by day, as opposed to 1 month and then the next month? Does it operate in real time?
Yeah.
So that didn't necessarily have to be a problem. So they had to shoot you from the shoulders up because they didn't want to show you were pregnant during that first pregnancy.
Yeah.
You must have had some pretty unusual shots that were done or some pretty unusual things that you had to do to ensure that the camera wouldn't see your stomach.
Well, I sat down a lot. I was behind a desk. Mercifully, for the first 6 months, I was in jail. I was innocent, but I was in jail. So I wore loose uniforms, and that covered it.
So you got the scarlet coat to cover it.
Yes, I got the scarlet for the wedding.
White,
yes.
So it didn't know it was scarlet. Now, when you had your second baby, they wrote the baby. You were pregnant on the show, and then they wrote the baby into the script. But you said that you would only go with that if they agreed to a couple of things. What were those things?
Well, they said they would give me the 9th month off. They never got around to that. And they also said that nothing would go wrong with the pregnancy or the child. The child would not have a bad cold until it was played by an actor. When the child was first born, they came to the hospital and photographed my little boy. And they came up to the house a few times and photographed him. I never would bring him to the studio. But the baby on the show was always Jeff. They never cast him, because about that time we changed writers, and the writers didn't like me or my child. And they, quite abruptly, I just picked up the script, they killed him off. And I had, the only recourse I had was to quit. It was playing the death of my own child, and that was rough. It was what I had said I didn't want to do. It's too close to home.
So how did you get through that?
I decided that I would get even with them. They said they were doing it for a rating. And I said, I didn't believe that killing a child would get a rating. I didn't believe people wanted to watch that. So I gave them a week of scripts that nobody could look at.
And
they were too painful.
Did you really lose viewers?
Yes, it went down.
Rating
went down.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to see that kind of pain. You run from it. People want to see an automobile accident. If it's somebody, you know, there's a... something that draws crowds around catastrophes, but that's not somebody you know. That's a stranger, and people are drawn, I suppose, to horror almost with the feeling, I'm glad it's not me. There's something in everybody that draws them to stop and rubberneck at an automobile accident. But that's different. You don't know who's in that car. If it was your brother, if it was somebody very close to you, you wouldn't stand and watch.
How have your children reacted to your career on television?
Oh, they're super. I didn't tell them where I went for a long time. I didn't want them... I was sad on the air. I didn't want them watching me and see that my mother goes someplace and cries. Because then they would misunderstand that as little bitty children. I guess they were 3 and 4, or maybe 4 and 5, before I took them to the studio the first time. And that was because my housekeeper didn't show up, but I had to. And unfortunately, it was a day that I was being held at gunpoint. And that worried me a lot. I thought, oh, Lord, they're going to see somebody holding a gun on Mother. Their reaction was not one that I should ever have worried about. Jeffrey walked in the studio and said, oh, hey, shoot. Go ahead, shoot.
What did that do to you to hear that?
I was relieved. They were very independent people. I think my working was good for them because it made them resourceful and self-reliant from a very early age. They knew I went to work. They didn't like my going out in the evenings, but they They never minded my going to work. They understood that was necessary.
Well, what image of motherhood and womanhood do you think viewers would get if they tried to learn how to live and learn what was correct and incorrect from watching Search for Tomorrow?
Oh, I don't think you learn that from watching Search. What it has contributed, I think, to a lot of people is a self-image in another environment. The soaps, daytime television, is a big help in fulfilling a fantasy. And there are a lot of people, I know I was a poor kid. Well, we weren't deprived, we were just poor. I grew up in hotel rooms and rotten little housekeeping flats in Oklahoma. And I know that listening to the soap operas, I could imagine myself in those places. It was a big help. You have to see yourself someplace else, or you're not going to grow. You're not going to get out of where you are. Even though you don't like it, you have to imagine yourself someplace else. I think it has done that, where we are too flat-out middle class, upper WASP middle class. Everybody has enough money. Money's never even mentioned. It's a little silly. But what it does do is there are a lot of people who haven't reached that level who get very used to seeing the inside of those living rooms and see themselves there. It has contributed that. It contributes also an affection. It is very warm inside some of the groups.
So what I was thinking is that if a woman who is a good woman and a respected woman in the series is, say, always making sacrifices and always working her fingers to the bone to provide for the family or to do a good turn for a friend, and if that's rewarded, you know, does that encourage people to do the same, to be a martyr, sacrificial?
No, that sounds awful. You know, unless that sounds sick. A lot of people work very hard for their families, but I think because they enjoy it. And then there comes a time when the kids are grown and they can relax. If it's working their fingers to the bone just for the reward they're going to get, then it's sick.
You know, a lot of studies are done in academic journals about what viewers learn or think they learn from watching soap operas.
I don't think we're not there to teach. We're there to fantasize.
Mary Hartman was really popular about 4 years ago,
yeah,
5 years ago.
Yeah, something like that.
Did you all watch that?
No, I didn't. It's too late at night for me. I go to sleep after the 10 o'clock news. I barely make it through that.
Well, do you think the people in soap operas were flattered or insulted by the fact that this extremely popular show was working on its parody of the genre?
Not upset by it, no. No, it was funny. It was good. It was so sick that it couldn't last. You could see at the beginning that it would wear itself out. The seeds of its own destruction were there because it was too bizarre. They didn't do what a wonderful comedy does, like Mary Tyler Moore, where the characters are really real. They are funny, and they go just that one step above, beyond reality, that makes it funny. They went so far that they destroyed themselves.
Mm-hmm. During the McCarthy period, were you directly affected and the people who you worked with?
Well, our director, his name was taken off. He was listed. Lee Grant was fired from our show. Ralph Bell was fired from our show. Charlie had to go down to Washington and, as he put it, he signed an affidavit. That could cost him $5,000 to have that privilege. And then he was invited up for a dinner of crow. He met his accuser. That's kind of a sad story. The man who had listed him and forced him really to go without salary for almost 2 years. He had to be paid other ways. Procter & Gamble was very good about it and protected Charles. But after the dinner, he'd had a little too much to drink. He was walking Charles back to his hotel, and he said, you know, I've got a daughter, and she was down there in New York, and them Reds, they never would hire her. It was all sour grapes. And think of the destruction that man caused, because his daughter was an actress and nobody would hire her.
Did you have a sense of what was happening?
Of course. You couldn't avoid it everywhere you looked.
Did you have a feeling that there was literally a list that names?
Oh, there was literally a list.
Is that mailed to the people at the top of the network?
Well, I was in Hollywood at the end of the listings out there when everybody was, when the Hollywood 10 were indicted. And my grandmother owned the Daily Worker. I was quite nervous.
Did you watch your activities carefully or watch who was behind you and in front of you when you were
no.
doing anything?
No, you can't do that. You can't live that way. And I'm kidding when I say I was nervous because my grandmother owned the Daily Worker years ago. Actually, she was the first feminist. She was a wonderful woman back in the old suffragette days.
You've been with Search for Tomorrow since 1951. How long do you think the series is going to continue?
I didn't think it was going to last more than 13 weeks to begin with, so I don't suppose I'm the one to ask. I don't know. It seems to me that the audience has changed so much. There are, as I said earlier, half the women, the workforce in this country is half women, and it's going to go up. More and more women are going back to work. Who will be there to watch? And it seems to me, really, that the networks are almost over. My son said that to me when he got out of college. He said he went to work for cable television because he said in 10 years there won't be networks. It'll all be cable. Maybe there will be soap opera networks. It'll all, you know, there'll just be one network that's all soap opera, one cable channel.
All soap opera all the time.
Yeah, as they will. Well, now there are news networks, there are music. In radio, you have lots and lots of channels. They'll do the same thing in television where they have got 30 or 40 channels open. They'll bounce all the soaps off one satellite.
It turns on me, some people probably feel like they know Joe, the character who you portray, better than they know members of their family. Because for people who've been watching you for all those years, they've seen your character go through half of a life and have seen the character go through all the crises and all the joys. And you're not necessarily with someone who's close to you as they're going through all of that. They were even with you when you were in prison.
Yes.
When you were supposed to be alone.
Yeah.
So I wonder what that is for someone to feel like they know someone on TV better than they know people in real life. It's been speculated, like, what's it like for people who watch a lot of TV to see crisis after crisis or, like, emotional incident after emotional incident for a whole afternoon?
Well, there are very few people who watch a whole afternoon, and I think the ones who do listen with half an ear, I don't think they get that involved.
Right.
The ones who watch one particular one, who just have one favorite show that they watch. The people who know me, since the book came out, because Joanne has lived in the same town all her life, and she talks to the same people, so the people who have so always related to me as Joanne. Now the book has enlarged the circle because the woman who plays Joanne has had quite a different life that goes in lots of different directions, but it's been that woman who was sort of behind her, sort of filling out the spaces between.
Do you plan to stay with the series?
Sure. It's like home. It's a wonderful place to operate from. Especially now, they don't demand that much from me. I only work 2 or 3 days a week. Plenty of time to do other things. Mm-hmm. I've earned it. My kids are grown, and it's fun.
Oh, good for you.
I would like to write another book.
Yeah.
I've outlined one, and they would like to buy it. And so it'll be fun to write that. Going to go sell this one first, and that's fun because I get to travel around the country and meet pretty girls like you. Talk to different people. It's interesting. Everywhere I've been in Philadelphia, I've met somebody new. I walked down the street. I walked in here, and the nice lady at the front desk watched it. Did you marry Martin? Yep, married Martin. Everybody who serves the table, who takes the money, the people behind the desk at the hotel.
So that's rewarding.
It's like old friends.
Yeah.
Well, it's neat.
Well, Mary Stewart, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us this afternoon. I've been speaking with Mary Stewart, who has been starring as Jo in Search for Tomorrow ever since the show began in 1951. She's now written an autobiography which tells about the show and the character as well as about her own life as Mary Stewart. And it's called Both of Me, and it's been published by Doubleday.